This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Roger Corman first made his reputation as the king of the quick, cheap genre film. My guest Dick Miller was in dozens of those films, like A Bucket of Blood, Little Shop of Horrors, Sorority Girl, The Terror, The Trip, and War of the Satellites. Several of the directors who grew up watching Corman's movies or got their start working for him later paid homage to Miller by casting him in their films. Martin Scorsese gave him the part of a club owner in New York, New York. Miller had a small part in Jonathan Demme's Swing Shift. Joe Dante cast Miller in every one of his films, including The Howling, Gremlins, and Gremlins 2, where he plays the neighbor who comes to visit just as the gremlin invasion begins. Before he made films, Dick Miller lived in New York, where he was writing, producing, and directing for TV and theater. He went to Los Angeles, hoping to write screenplays, but he met Roger Corman, who offered him a role in a film.
He was doing his, I believe, a second film, a picture called Apache Woman with Lloyd Bridges. And the guy who introduced me said, Dick's a writer. You need any scripts? He says, I got plenty of writers. I don't need any scripts. I need actors. I said, I'm an actor. He said, okay, I'll stick you in a movie. I played an Indian in my first picture. And about halfway through, he asked me, he said, would you like to play a cowboy? I said, you're doing another movie already? He says, no, in the same movie. And I said, you're kidding. He said, no. He said, come back next week, you'll play a cowboy in town. So I wound up playing a cowboy and an Indian in my first movie. And darn near came close to shooting myself in the final shootout scene at the end.
Did anybody in the audience notice that it was the same person who was a cowboy and an Indian?
I don't think so, since it was so early. I mean, there was nothing to recognize. Nobody could say, oh, I've seen him before. A lot of dark makeup and some nose plugs. And the difference was, you could tell, that if you look close, if somebody said, that's the same guy, you'd say, oh, of course it is. But I don't think anybody was looking that close.
Did you have to learn how to ride a horse for the movie?
Oh, yeah, the old Hollywood story. Can you ride? Yes, you know. Can you jump out of an airplane? Sure. without a parachute? Of course. You know, they ask you all kinds of things, and you got to lie and say, of course I can do that. I had ridden a little up to that point, horses in stables in Central Park and places like that, and dude ranches, but nothing like cowboys and Indians. And I just figured, I've seen it done, I can do it. And that's pretty much how I learned. I learned on the first picture.
You played the lead in the 1959 Roger Corman movie, Bucket of Blood. And this has become a real cult classic. It was the leading role. You were a waiter in a beatnik coffee house. And you become an artist by covering first your dead cat in clay, and then by killing people and covering the corpses in clay and passing it off as sculpture. And once this artist becomes really acclaimed, you also become quite the hipster. Was it fun to spoof the hipster in the movie?
Well, it was made at the height of the coffee shop era. Everybody was going in for espresso.
You mean the coffee house, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the basic idea behind the picture, was the hipster coffee house groupies at that time, and the people who hung around, and the no talents and the talents of that era. And I think later on, Roger Corman made a picture called The Trip about the first, you know, big psychedelic outings that were going on, which was a little more serious. But it was also meant to cover that genre of what was happening at the moment. I love making Bucket of Blood. I think it still stands as my favorite picture.
The movie was shot in, I think, 5 days. Can you give us an idea of how you made a movie that quickly?
Well, 5 days was not as tight as it seemed. They were making TV half-hour shows in 2.5 days, and people who had that down had that type of that was a finger snap.
Right.
People who had that down at that moment could make movies that fast. We were when I started with Roger, we were making westerns, and we would make them in 6 days, and that was seemed like a fair amount of time. And later on, we got an extra day, a seventh day or an eighth day, and I thought, this is great. What a luxury. So by the time we got around to making A Bucket of Blood, 5 days was kind of a press, but most of the picture was shot in two sets. So it wasn't that much of a push. It's a matter of learning the technique. I think later on, when he made the famous Little Shop of Horrors, which was supposed to have been made in 2 days, and actually 2 days and a couple of spare nights, that also wasn't too much of a push. The people who were involved in it seemed to think, well, 2 days, okay, we'll try it, and if it doesn't work, we'll add another day.
But I understand you were offered the lead in Little Shop of Horrors, but you turned it down. Why didn't you take it?
I have a track record of turning down a lot of pictures for a lot of unknown reasons, even to myself. I think at that time, and I was hungry in those days, I would turn down jobs and say, I don't want to do it. I turned down Little Shop of Horrors because I had just finished doing Bucket of Blood, and I thought I was being asked to do the same character again. This was before they had sequels. If I had known it was going to be a sequel or a sequel character, I probably would have done it and been very happy. I kind of regretted it over the years. I turned it down kind of on an artistic level. I said, I've done this part. I don't want to do it again. Give it to somebody else. Give it to Jonathan, who was a very close personal friend of mine at the time. And I felt, give him the shot. I don't care. I said, I'll do anything in it.
Well, the role you did end up playing in Little Shop of Horrors was someone who's always hanging out in the flower shop eating the flowers. You were the plant-eating person instead of the instead of the man-eating plant. and for people who don't know the story, it's the story of a guy who creates this plant, and the plant eats the plant thrives on blood, so he's always killing people to feed the plant. So did you actually eat carnations for your role?
Yeah, I they suggested that this was the character who was going to do this, and I thought, okay, fine, I'll take a bite. When you say cut, I'm going to spit it out and get rid of it. And the only drawback was that the carnations, I'm sure, Roger didn't go out and buy the freshest flowers. I don't know where he got them. They were kind of stale and old, and they were probably full of pesticides. But once I got them in my mouth, they didn't taste so bad. So I figured I'll chew them up and I'll see what happens. And it worked out fine. I actually became a flower eater from that picture.
You became a flower eater?
I've been known to steal centerpieces at weddings and things like that and take them home and eat them.
Seriously?
Oh, yes.
You're not pulling my leg on this?
No, I like flowers. If I get a chance, it's not a constant thing. Don't think it's a way of life with me. I go around eating flowers all the time. But I'll find myself maybe once a year or twice a year eating a rose or something that tastes good.
Huh. You know, Roger Corman says that Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors were part of a new genre that he felt he was creating, the black comedy horror film. And I was wondering if you felt that all the actors had a good sense of humor, the kind of sense of humor that would get all of what was happening in the movie, you know, and enjoy the jokes.
I think at the time he was making those films, Roger didn't have the greatest sense of humor. I have to be honest about that. He wasn't quite sure that Bucket of Blood was going to be a comedy. He thought it was kind of a very serious thriller at the time. That's the truth. And all the people involved with him at the time had great senses of humor. I mean, it was not uncommon for us on location shots to play what you would call dirty tricks on Roger, because he didn't quite catch on to what we were doing at the time. But I'm not saying that he was ignorant of the fact that it was going to be a comedy. I think about halfway through he got the idea that this is funny, you know, these people are funny. And when he finished it, he said, we've got to make another one. This is how Little Shop of Horrors came about. He says, this is funny. We must make another picture just like it.
Give me an example of the kind of dirty trick that the actors would play on Corman.
It wasn't really a group thing. It was, I think it was more Jonathan Hayes and myself. We had an expression, show me what you mean. He would say, we were out in Hawaii shooting a picture. He said, run out there to the end of the coral and look around and then come running back. And we'd say, show us what you mean, Roger. And he'd run out there and come back, and his feet would be bloody through his sneakers. I mean, it was just the coral would cut him up something awful. Or he would say, leap over this ditch, grab those bushes, and pull yourself into the cane field. Well, we were told, never touch the cane, the sugar cane. It's got these little burrs on it. And somebody would say, show us what you mean, Roger. He'd jump, he'd grab the bushes, and we'd take out an hour while somebody washed his hands out.
Well, did he expect you to do it after he proved that this was a really dangerous and impossible thing to do?
Yes, and we'd do it. I mean, once it was shown to us, we said, okay, fine, you know. But we usually took more precautions than he had taken.
Actor Dick Miller is my guest. How come you stayed with Roger Corman for so long, and how long was it?
Let's see. When I went to work for Roger, I was not that serious about my career. I still didn't know if I wanted to be a writer, although I had stopped writing the minute I worked in as an actor in movies. I just said, this is kind of nice. I found it very easy to work for him. He was doing a lot of work, and I mean as many as 5 or 6 films a year, which is unheard of. The studios, you know, major studios barely turn out that kind of product. So I stayed with Roger 5 or 6 years and wound up doing about 35 films for him in that period. The work was easy. It was constant. I didn't have to look for jobs, which is the most difficult part of being an actor, I think. Mm-hmm. And I found myself, every couple of months, I'd get a call from him and say, we're going to do another picture, and we got a nice part for you. And as the roles got better, it became easier and easier to stay in that position.
Did he always write a role for you?
He didn't write a role for me. I will always be grateful for Roger for the fact that he didn't write roles for me. He let me do almost any part that came up. I think the opening picture was kind of the sign of which way we were going. I played a cowboy and an Indian. Well, you're not going to typecast me that way. You know? You're not going to say, this guy does West, he does cowboys only or Indians only. I suddenly found myself playing rocket scientists, demented busboys, leading men, villains, everything. And he never said, you can't do that part. You know, he'd say, can you do this? Can you do that? I said, I can do anything. And I found myself in 35 pictures playing practically 35 different roles. I don't think many actors get that kind of opportunity.
How soon did you try to establish your career away from Corman?
I think that happened. It's a stage of life you go through. It's more than a career change. After so many years, I started to put on a little weight and get a little heavy, and was entering middle age, and there wasn't that much work around for me. He said, you want to play truck drivers or, you know, redneck sheriffs? Or it seemed like I was not getting the work I wanted. And by that time, I had established a fairly good name in the business, and that was the first time I really started to move out and see if I could work for other people. I don't see it was a fallow period, but there wasn't that much work, and then suddenly it started again. I guess I lost weight, I changed my image, I built up some muscles, and I started a new career again.
Mm-hmm. So when you changed your image and you started again, what kind of roles did you get?
Now it was pretty definite that I was not going to be doing too many leading roles. Because, again, the age group was different, and you don't find yourself doing that many parts. I was playing gangsters and cops. I was doing the same thing I had done before, only in smaller parts. And then things would come up like Heart Like a Wheel, and then The Howling. I had met Joe Dante. I think that was probably the big change in my career. And we got along pretty good, and he asked me to do something in Hollywood, Hollywood Boulevard, and it turned out to be one of my favorite parts. I just love the scenes. It wasn't a big part, but it seemed to be very outstanding when it was all done. And based on that, I went to work doing a lot more pictures in that genre, the new horror films and the films of that nature.
Well, Joe Dante has cast you in every one of the movies that he's made. And I think that a lot of the people who became well-known directors after working for Roger Corman ended up casting you in their films. You know, Joe Dante is an example. Alan Arkush, you were in his Rock and Roll High School. Help me out with this. What are some other examples?
Okay, Marty Scorsese.
Yeah, New York, New York. You played a club owner.
Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan.
So were you self-conscious
Steven
about
Spielberg,
this?
Oh, really? Not to overlook Steven.
Were you self-conscious about this, knowing that people were paying homage to you in a way? I mean, they'd seen you in all these movies. Do you know what I mean? And your parts were, in a way, an homage to yourself.
I was flattered, and I think probably Scorsese was the first one who summed it up for me when he was doing New York, New York. I went to see him, and I said, what do you want me to read? And he says, I've been watching you since I'm 13 years old. You don't have to read for me, you know. He says, you got the part. Bobby De Niro is going to come in here, and we'll try some ad libs and see how if you got that feeling with each other, which we did. And that was it. And I suddenly realized there were a lot of guys out there who started watching me when they were young teenagers and spent 10, 15 years watching me, and now they're grown up and they're producing and directing and writing, and they want to use me, and I really was flattered. It took a while for it to reach me, but once it did, I was truly flattered.
You know, after working on all these quickie movies, like cheap quickie movies, what was it like for instance, to work with Martin Scorsese on New York, New York, playing in a scene with Robert De Niro, and he's so famous for spending a really long time intensely getting into his character. And I'm sure it's, in a way, the opposite approach that actors had to take in the quickie Corman films, where you've got 2 days to shoot the whole movie.
Well, Bobby De Niro, actually, well, he started with Roger. He's also from that school.
Oh, I didn't realize he'd started with him, too.
Along with Nicholson. And if you put these guys to the test, you'll find out that they all know how to work fast. When the luxury of time came their way, then they started to use it. But basically, De Niro was right on top of, you know, let's shoot quick, let's get it done, let's get it over. Except his particular style is to stretch it out and ad-lib and see how long he can make the scenes and everything. I've worked with a lot of people, and those who come from that background all seem to be able to do that. It's not a big thing. Today, the school of doing that is probably the soaps. They get to work in soaps, and they have to learn a script in one day and go in and do it. So I think the background of most actors, somewhere along the line, if they've had any experience at all, covers that type of fast work, rapid work. There are people who get into the business, they get in lucky, young kids, and they really don't have any background at all. They're looking to establish a mood or create some inner feeling of some kind, but it's a lot of... I don't want to say it. It's a lot of unnecessary activity.
Actor Dick Miller is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
I'm from the Apple, New York. I grew up a combination of places there, Long Island, the Bronx, Manhattan. Did many, many things before I became an actor. I was always interested in show business, but I kind of saw myself as a singer and a musician. I played drums professionally for a while. I was with Bobby Sherwood, the big band leader, for a while, although I didn't work in his big band. I worked in small groups with him. And always kind of thought of myself that I would be a singer one day. I worked at that for a while professionally and really didn't care for it so much, to be singing for other people.
What kind of material did you sing?
Pops, kind of like Nat Cole and Frank Sinatra, that genre. I was just a pop singer. A lot of jazz, though. Mm-hmm. I love jazz, and that was the world I played in, played drums in the jazz world. And I like that kind of music. I remember taking a fling at acting when I was about 15 or 16 years old. A friend said, "Do you want a free summer vacation? All you have to do is paint some flats for me, and... There's free food, free room, free girls, everything you want to spend your summer with." And I went up there and I painted flats for a while, and I was watching the acting, and I said, "I can do that." And he gave me a shot out. He says, "You're going to play a butler." And I had very few lines. I won't make this a long, boring story. I wound up forgetting every line. And I was going, and the other actor on stage who I was working with had been pre-warned, and he took all my lines and he made him questions and said, "Yes, there's somebody here to see me. Do you want to show him in?" And he did all of that, and a big laugh for everybody. But by the end of the summer, I had turned out to be the company character actor, and I enjoyed it. But I didn't touch it again for 4 or 5 years.
Weren't you also a psychologist?
Yes, I'm a graduate psychologist. I went to... Columbia, and worked at that briefly, and decided I didn't want to be dealing with the crazy people. And then I came out to Hollywood, where everybody's nuts, and it served me a good standing. I thought at one time I would do that. I come from a family of professionals, mostly lawyers. I have my kid brother is a Supreme Court justice in New York State, and my older brother was the coroner of Orange County and also an attorney, and my nephews. I'm probably the only non-attorney in my family. And I thought, well, I'll do something along those lines, but I didn't enjoy it. It's not that I didn't enjoy it, it's that I enjoyed the world of music and acting better, so I just kind of drifted into it.
I'm wondering if any of the patients that you had during the brief time that you were a psychologist ended up seeing your movies like Bucket of Blood and wondering, this is the guy who is going to help me?
That would be very funny. I don't know. Most of the people I was dealing with were I worked at Bellevue for a while, and the cases that came in there, like, they wouldn't have recognized me the next morning.
What are your ambitions now? What kinds of roles would you like to be doing?
That's hard to tell. I somehow don't see myself as getting older. I keep looking to see if when my hair is going to turn gray or when I'm going to get back the pot belly I had when I was in my 40s. It's not there. I look pretty good. And I just keep thinking, what is there around for me? You know, there isn't too many parts for older guys. You hit a certain age and it stops. You're not a leading man, and you're not the competition for the leading man. You're almost too old to play the fathers and the police chiefs, and it creeps up on you. I don't know. I'd probably like to play somebody's grandfather who's very rough and tough, and either as an ex private eye or an ex cowboy or an ex seaman or something. Pretty much, I'd like to play myself. That's what I've been doing for 35 years.
What was your reaction when you saw people who you were working with become famous, like Jack Nicholson, who had one of his first roles in Little Shop of Horrors?
Now that's supposed to be the questions that hurt and really get in deep, but they don't. Jack and I were personal friends for a lot of years. Almost from the time he started making movies, we became buddies. And the relationship stayed that way until he became a huge star, because there is a difference in lifestyles. It's not like your friend is making a quarter of a million or a half a million or even $1 million a year. That you can cope with. He's living a little better than you. But when a guy's making $10 million and $20 million, and I believe he made about $50 or $60 million on his last picture, it becomes almost impossible to maintain a relationship, a personal relationship, because you're either a part of the entourage or, you know, you cease to be a friend. You cease to be part. You become part of the group. So we drifted away from each other. When we see each other, we're friendly, and I think there's probably a great deal of respect for each other there. But as these guys made it, I try to figure out what is it that they have that I don't have. Why is it that the bright teeth or the straight nose or the whatever it is that makes them a star? What got them the edge? I didn't feel bad. I always figured this could still happen to me. Even now, I figure I could still get lucky. Something could come along, and I could get lucky and suddenly become hot. You don't have to be a leading man. You could be a John Goodman. You could be a character actor that gets lucky. Something comes along in your career. But basically, if you understand that it is fate, maybe not even that, it's luck. It's luck and not necessarily talent. You can live with it. Because that luck could be yours, too.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And my guest has been actor Dick Miller, and he's currently appearing in Gremlins 2, directed by Joe Dante. And he's been in all of Joe Dante's films, lots of Roger Corman movies, and lots of other movies as well, including New York, New York, and Terminator, Rock and Roll High School. And a lot of these movies are now out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.